Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Attribution, a novel by Linda Moore, narrated by Sarah Wellborn. Chapter 1. Spiderwebs covered the storeroom door with taut and wispy fragments, evidence that this basement room hadn't been opened in years, maybe decades. Kate ran her fingers over the door's painted surface, cracked like an alligator's back, and with a flick, paint chips fell away, drifting down like so many abandoned aspirations. She placed her palm, fingers outstretched to cover the exposed area of yellowed paint, a surface that so resembled the faux finish on Maddie's coffin, the touch of it turned her cold. Memories of Maddie found their way into her thoughts, but she swept them aside as she pushed back from the door and tried the locked handle again, without success. 20 minutes had passed since she'd phoned security to come open the door, and her patience, in short supply on a normal day, ticked away with the clock. This was no normal day. Today, she would finish the art inventory of New York City University and dismiss the undergraduate team, now on their obligatory coffee break. She'd supervise their assignment to locate every artwork either in the remodeled vault with its climate controls or on the walls of Hamilton Hall. This storeroom was an odd room not listed nor pointed out by the registrar, but she'd noticed the door when exiting the art vault to make a phone call. Nothing should be kept outside the vault in this dank cellar, especially not art. Anyone sensible would stop now, turn in the forms with every item checked, and tell Professor Jones the scut work he'd assigned to avoid another dissertation meeting with her was complete. Escape their cha-cha dance of her moving 2 steps forward with ideas and him stepping her 3 quick steps backward with the list of reasons her proposals fell short. The whole inventory project stole time from dissertation research. Jones might not know this room existed, but it would be just her luck if the self-important art history star had laid a trap to send her back to the basement because she'd not been thorough. A setup. A gotcha moment he'd relish. A jangle of metal echoed in the cavernous cellar. A security guard attached to the sound appeared from around the corner brandishing an immense key ring like a weapon. He scowled.
Guards don't come down here without a call from the department chair.
She smiled, a weak attempt to reset his unexpected attitude, and squinted to read his name badge. Julio, Kate from the art department. Do you have a key for this door? She straightened the bottom of her turtleneck and pulled it to cover her worn jeans. Julio shrugged and throttled back his attitude. Professor's rules, not mine. She took the clipboard from her messenger bag, brushed strands of hair from her face, and put on her glasses. A printout with Professor Jones's note to locate every piece of art, no exceptions. Julio didn't look at the note. He scrunched his mouth and looked straight at her with a smirk.
Jones got you doing the dirty work, eh? When the Emperor calls us to come to his office, we all got excuses. Everybody busy somewhere else.
He's the boss. Julio snickered, bent down, and struggled to try a key. Too much rust. Haven't been used in years. He mumbled curse words in Spanish, some real whoppers, different from what she'd heard 2 summers ago in Madrid or during her high school stay in Mexico City. He stood, stretched his back, and groaned. The buttons on his uniform shirt strained against his stomach, just like Dad, who suffered from watching sports instead of playing them. She pulled the water bottle from her bag and held it toward him. My dad's got a bad back, too. Painful? He stared, perhaps reassessing an impression she was a spoiled art type from the Upper East Side, and then accepted the bottle. Between twists of his back, side to side, he took long drinks of water and then searched the ring for a different key. This might be it. He bent over with a wince and tried the lock. The bolt released and the door creaked open.
Well done!
She lifted her hand to high-five him. He left his arms at his side.
You never seen me. She lowered her hand and gave a quick nod. Call us to lock up,
he shouted over his shoulder as he jingled down the passageway.
With a slight push, the door opened wider to a room about 12 feet square. The scent of trapped air and other smells she didn't care to think about caught her by surprise. A godlike shaft of light from a window near the ceiling shone on dust particles in the darkness and lit a lacework of, no surprise, more spiderwebs. She shuddered and studied the lacy threads for the artful sculptors, but only dust wafted in the air over file boxes stacked within a foot of the ceiling. Those web spinners were hiding somewhere. She gazed upward, saw nothing but rusted pipes, and turned to wedge herself between columns of file boxes crammed together. She nudged one box marked Published Dissertations 1970 to 1990 back into the stack and considered the weight and volume, literal and emotional, of the student's work it contained. The pressure to secure Jones's approval on a thesis topic buzzed in her ears like a swarm of hornets and renewed the urgency to complete the inventory so she could return to her research. Another file box marked Correspondence protruded from the stack, and when she bumped into it, the box tumbled and folders of handwritten notes and letters toppled onto the floor. She scraped the folders into a pile. The top one had a handwritten label that read, Letters from L. One brittle envelope with no addressee contained a short note, a paragraph about brushstrokes and religious themes and artworks, oddly signed Mother. Her own mother barely appreciated the Baroque art Kate studied, except for the Madonna. Mom, just 46, kneeled more often now below Mary's saccharine face in the nave of Holy Family Church, and prayed for strength and comfort that might come from another mother who'd buried a son. Art crates, lids detached, a sure sign they were empty, were stacked at the rear of the storeroom. She maneuvered forward to make certain, but saw something else, a corner of carved wood near the wall. She rocked an empty but still heavy crate inch by inch to move it out of the way, earning a splinter in her thumb. She'd deal with it later in better light. A wooden chest, maybe walnut, had fat-cheeked cherubs holding a ribbon between grapevines carved into the lid. The figure surrounded a royal crest she didn't recognize. 16th century, or maybe earlier, similar to the ones she'd seen in a museum catalog. The lid fell, her fingers escaping a crushing blow. She lifted more cautiously, propping the top securely against the back wall. Rumpled packing paper filled the inside. With two fingers, she gingerly removed a paper or two, then scooped bunches with her arms, praying no creature would jump out. This chest, an object of some value, was out of place in this cellar, incongruous and forgotten. Wild ideas surged in her imagination about why it might be here. Art history wasn't a romance novel, but people found important things all the time. Packing paper in an empty chest didn't make sense. This chest most certainly had a story. She knelt on the filthy floor for a closer look. That a rat, by the odor of the inside, might jump out any second, forced her to fortify her resolve, plunge her arm in, and move her fingers quickly from left to right systematically along the bottom, like reading Braille. Something was there, on the bottom, a frayed edge of fabric, not a rag nor a weaving, something stiffer and rolled. This might be something. Papers went flying, tossed everywhere, until there it was. A painting. Unmistakable. A rolled, painted canvas. She stopped breathing, and then gasped, breathless from the manic unpacking and the surprise that this room held an artwork after all. A canvas of some heft had been rolled a number of times, paint side out to prevent cracking, as was the practice of the last century. Rich pigments glistened in the cell phone light. She tried to lift the roll, but the painting wouldn't budge. Humidity and time had fixed it to the bottom. With hands trembling from the fear of damaging a work that might be important or might be trash, and knowing to proceed with protocols as if it was the former, she nudged the canvas by rocking it in tiny motions. The painting loosened, moved, and to her relief, detached from the bottom. She lifted the artwork with two hands underneath like a newborn infant being brought from its mother's womb and set the canvas onto a cradle of file boxes. The dimensions were larger than she'd guessed, maybe 3 feet high and twice as long. With her cell phone light, she examined the paint on the outside of the canvas and found significant croquelure showing age and potential risk due to its dry condition. Even one turn to unroll the stiff canvas might flake the pigment or tear the linen. She suppressed the urge to flatten the roll to view the whole image and instead stood back, focused on taking a deep breath, summoning patience to respect the art. She turned the roll over and focused the light to view the edge. Could it be lapis lazuli pigment? Expensive and important, only used on works that mattered, shimmering even in the dim light. Evidence the pigment had been hand-ground was revealed in the granular texture, dating it to hundreds of years of age. That ultramarine color had been applied with brush strokes. The few that were visible worked together with exactness and an expressive freedom. She stood back for perspective to view strokes that defined realistic folds of velvet, perhaps draperies or an elegant skirt, painted in red lake carmine, another priceless color hiding under aged varnish. She examined the backside of the linen covered with irregular slubs only found in hand-woven fabric. The ground from red clay used to prepare the front side of the canvas had bled through the back. Her heart rate increased with each bit of information tested against her knowledge of the practices of certain artists she'd studied. The style, those costly pigments, the precise brush strokes combined with spontaneous dabs, like those royal paintings she'd studied at the Prado. Could it be? A European masterwork in the cellar of an American university, not the attic of an English country house chock-a-block with such things, or the rectory of a regional church rolled up in armoires that held liturgical vestments, places such things were expected to be discovered, was at the least highly improbable. She focused the light again at the canvas edge, doubting what her eyes, with certainty, had seen. The cracks in the canvas declared it old in a way that could not be forged. Her imagination leapt ahead with the possibilities, resisted the counter-arguments, and overflowed with an intuitive conviction that this was something. Something she could not see the whole of and should not speculate. And yet the possibility could not be denied. Could it be a, she couldn't say the name? Even a solitary whisper in this cavern might let the unthinkable into the universe. An attribution so audacious, she could only shout it in silence. Chapter 2. Kate wrapped the canvas in paper, her hands shaking at the touch of this unlikely, too soon to know, maybe masterpiece. Possibilities deserve space to blossom until they were ruled out. Whatever the work proved to be, it deserved cautious respect. Rolled in the packing papers, the canvas appeared an unremarkable parcel, nothing more, and its ordinariness would enable her to carry it upstairs out of the basement. In that way, she and this parcel were similar. She could leave the basement where Jones had exiled her, move upstairs unnoticed, and when the right time arrived, reveal this extraordinary find. No. That was beyond aspirational, getting way ahead of the required research and, yes, her commitment to scholarship to see the whole of it, to identify with precision and references what it likely was before racing ahead. First stop would be the third floor Conservation Center's humidity chamber, where the stiffness could be removed and the canvas unrolled without risking damage. The hallway to the elevator was empty in both directions. Her gut told her to keep the canvas secret. It just did. The curious undergrads would ask questions, speculate, and gossip about the mysterious find. Better to see the whole thing, build a case for Jones to consider the artwork something of substance, worthy of serious study, or if research revealed the work was a pastiche, she would return it without embarrassing herself again. But if that red clay ground used to prepare the canvas, the handmade linen, that glimpse of ultramarine and carmine red, and their granular texture led where she suspected, Jones could not dismiss the artwork. Those factors offered clues mostly to the age of the work and the wealth of the patron, but composition and subject would provide material evidence. Chemical tests of pigments and linen fragments could identify precise dates and a list of possible artists within those dates, but style and image, that first intuitive look, seeing what the composition might disclose, could support or reject this wild hypothesis that kept running through her head. It was noon, and Mary Murphy, the center's director, would be at lunch. Mary's Irishness, that loquaciousness, added a lilt to the dour winter and joyless academic ambiance. Mary could have answered many questions, especially about the conservation process and the operation of the humidifier, but if Mary saw the painting and shared the find with colleagues, the pretentious art cabal would opine and squeeze out a junior scholar like herself. Mary, the lovely, likable Mary, was incapable of discretion. Directors in London at a conference. The clerk mumbled between chomps of her chewing gum, her attention focused on the phone receiver. The young woman, attractive, probably a student, put the call on hold and added, "Until after the holidays." "Too bad." Kate pretended to view a brochure on the counter to hide her relief. "I need the humidifier." "Only Mary knows how to use that thing. Register their work and put it in the storage lockers. She'll call you when she returns." The phone rang. The gal ignored the caller on hold and answered the next call. Kate pantomimed signing, and the clerk set a clipboard on the counter while she argued about an invoice with the caller. The clipboard form required details Kate didn't have, but she registered the painting as unknown European. The girl took the log back and smiled. She actually did, for the first time. Kate returned a nervous grin and proceeded through the turnstile. The humidity chamber's instructions were written in a bad translation of German. She pieced together meanings and merged those sketchy instructions with the course demonstration she'd had at orientation. The treatment depended on the materials, the medium that bound the pigments to the linen, as well as the type of canvas, none of which were known to her. If she got it wrong, paint could flake or separate from the surface. Her minimal training had never been put into practice. She stood, hands trembling, fearful she could harm the work, and lifted the top. The rolled canvas fit inside the chamber, a tent sort of contraption, with little room to spare. She set the dials and crossed her fingers she wouldn't find paint fragments when she opened it. She could do this, perhaps not as well as Mary, but well enough. She closed the cover. A cast-off couch in the corner provided a perch to monitor the painting through the humidifier's transparent top. She'd have hours to observe progress and make certain no one came in to question or disturb the process, the machine didn't blow up or the building catch fire, space aliens abducted, or whatever else popped into her relentless imagining that lately calibrated toward the negative. She pushed these possible calamities aside, sunk into the couch, and her mind drifted toward home, toward sad Ypsilanti and the calamity of her life, her brother's drowning. When Maddie died 2 years ago, she'd abandoned her doctoral program at the University of Michigan, took a terminal master's degree, and found a curatorial assistant job at the Detroit Institute of the Arts. She struggled to help her grieving family end the deafening silence of her brother's absence and conquer the guilt. The secret she'd hidden from them, those amphetamines she'd left on the bathroom counter, the why of Maddie's death that even the coroner didn't discover, ate at every bit of her soul, her spirit consumed by what she could not, would not say. But she knew, she'd known, seen the signs when he'd returned from reckless parties. The 5 years between them meant she should have been a good big sister, But she'd said nothing to him or their parents about the perilous path Maddie tread with the other high school seniors. He was their parents' darling boy, the one that could do no wrong, made them laugh, drew pride at every soccer match and honors that would propel this family to the heights Dad dreamed of while he worked the assembly line. What would be the point of the truth? In their minds, he'd live forever as unrealized perfection. Matthew had drowned, and whether by his own hubris or a horrible accident, she'd loved him too. Mom and Dad had nothing left for her, didn't see that her life might have value, could be enough for them. She'd fled to New York, still in shock she'd been accepted to the doctoral program after she'd withdrawn from Michigan, but clear-eyed that at 23 she must embark on a solitary journey, unmoored from those rocks she'd once clung to, anchors now submerged in the tide of grief. When she'd arrived in September, the Palladian entrance to Hamilton Hall had left her speechless with exhilaration about her future prospects. She launched herself forward to breathe oxygen onto the embers of her own dreams. And now, the idea that her accomplishments might be enough to fill the hole in their hearts slipped away each time Professor Jones rejected her work, rejected her. That revitalizing breath spent, leaving her breathless, not an awestruck kind of breathless like when she stood before a marvel of a painting, more like gasping for air to survive. But there'd be no quitting. How many times was that drilled into her head by her teachers, her coaches, and her parents? This next proposal, her fourth, needed to earn Jones's support, or this fragile framework of a future would collapse again. She'd anticipate Jones's questions and nail this attempt. This proposed study of two little-known, almost unknown, women artists from the Baroque period should impress Jones with its originality and meet his demands for unique research. A few references to these Portuguese women, one a cloistered nun and the other an unmarried woman assisting her father in his studio, existed. She'd scoured everything available in New York and online. Jones never wrote or spoke about women artists. The Spanish Golden Age was his specialty area, a playing field he dominated, and he knew it, like an athlete in constant self-congratulatory mode. Female painters were lost from history except for Artemisia Gentileschi and maybe one or two others. There had to be more, but the notion more women existed to be uncovered did not gain his support. And support from Jones mattered. 4 hours had passed in what seemed minutes while she'd explored topics she loved, soothed by the hum of air flowing through the chamber. She rose, stretched her legs, took a few steps, and peeked her head around the corner to see what the clerk was doing. The desk was empty and the computer turned off. Maybe the clerk had forgotten she was in there and had left for a class. Kate studied the humidifier and decided to open it before the clerk returned. She closed her eyes, unable to pray since Maddie died, to summon positive karma as she lifted the top. No paint flakes. She nudged the canvas that was a bit damp, maybe too damp. The roll moved about a foot and stopped, revealing a bit more of the image she'd spotted in the storeroom. The remaining layers of canvas clung together, still stiff. The painting would require days in the chamber to relax enough to roll out. Days meant a lot of moisture, and the paint could detach from the canvas as the linen fibers swelled. She turned off the machine and lifted the canvas to a large table. The canvas unrolled a little more, then a little more, and she positioned weights to hold each section down, but two-thirds of it remained too stiff to unroll. She could stay and sleep on the couch, but looking at the stained cushions, maybe not. People had left for the holidays, but someone still could come into the room. She covered the canvas with clean muslin and scribbled a sign, "Do not touch." Hopefully, the moist air now filling the lab would continue to relax the canvas. She picked up her coat and computer bag to head home. Voices came from the reception area where the clerk chatted with someone. The two girls, probably students, were comparing different bars and the guys who took up residence at each. Her repertoire in such things ranged from limited to non-existent, and she'd ceased longing for that carefree life or anything that diverted her from her career. She swept around the corner, past the desk, and, with aplomb, sent words flying over her shoulder. "Have fun tonight." The apartment she'd sublet offered refuge from the frenetic city and recovery from what had been lost in each day's struggle. The fridge contained leftover Chinese, an unpleasant dinner option, but preferable to another withdrawal from her dwindling bank account. She nibbled at the tangled noodles and red course material. After a few tasteless bites, she moved the reading sans noodles to her bed, hoping the ponderous pages would bring sleep instead of a head filled with wild possibilities. The alarm showed 4 o'clock in glowing numerals. Images of what the unrolled painting might look like had kept her awake. Sleep was hopeless, and she abandoned her bed for a kitchen chair. Old coffee warmed in the microwave energized her to review her dissertation draft. Yesterday's caffeine and yesterday's ideas, the proposal had been edited 20 times. She shook her head and chuckled more from fatigue than amusement. She could not force herself to read it again and printed it out. Computer tabs marked the biographies of artists who might have painted the artwork resting in the conservation center. The list was short, and she studied them all. The cities where they'd worked, where they'd lived, who they'd known, and, of course, images and dates of their works. She deleted possibilities that didn't fit, pausing to reflect and then trusting her eye to distinguish pigments and brushstrokes from what she'd observed on 12 inches of the painting, her painting. Sun poured through the studio window. She stretched and watched clouds of warm smoke break the freezing air's grip on the sky. It was almost 6 and she needed to get dressed. She put on her art people wear black turtleneck, a simple skirt, and black tights to protect her legs against the cold. The center opened at 7, and she wanted to be there before anyone else arrived, even though the clerk would likely be late for work after her evening antics. The temperature hit her hard, even as a veteran of Michigan winters where locals mocked complaints about the cold. A taxi would be nice, but a walk to the subway was cheaper and would clear her head. Money from her graduate grant would be deposited at the beginning of the semester in January, another penny-counting 20 days or so. She pulled a subway token from her pocket, grabbed the train, got off at Washington Square, and sprinted from the exit to Hamilton Hall before her nose froze. She climbed the stairs to the entrance as the university clock tower sounded the chimes for 7. No surprise, the clerk wasn't at her desk. Kate pushed the turnstile into the lab and tossed the winter gear, now making her sweat, onto the couch. The muslin cover appeared untouched. She put on her cotton gloves, took a deep breath, lowered her tense shoulders, and cautiously pulled back the fabric. She lifted the rolled part of the canvas, lighter and more pliable, like a patient ready for examination. The ancillary light, together with the surgical overhead lamp, illuminated the table where the patient waited. She reminded herself to slow her racing heart, to breathe, and to move with purpose and precision. With a gentle nudge, the canvas rolled a bit, and then a bit more, until the entire thing weighted backside toward her. She lifted the painting with 2 fingers of each gloved hand, stretching her arms out like a crucifixion to hold the painting's full width stable, and then turned the artwork to spread it onto the table. With the front side now fully visible, she held her breath to contain tears welling up in an emotion like seeing a newborn's face for the first time. Extraordinary. Stunning. She grabbed her cheeks and then the edge of the table to steady herself and to quell the feelings overtaking her. Painted poetry glowed and throbbed with passion in the sterile atmosphere of the lab. The artistry, the composition, and brilliant craft made this painting an exceptional example of the Baroque period.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?